and it is clear that many of them were genuinely concerned with philosophy. Plato devoted himself to caricaturing and vilifying them, but they must not be judged by his polemics. In his lighter vein, take the following passage from the Euthydemus, in which two sophists, Dionysodorus and Euthydemus, set to work to puzzle a simple-minded person named Clesippus. Dionysodorus begins, "You say that you have a dog." "Yes, a villain of a one," said Clesippus. "And he has puppies?" "Yes, and they are very like himself." "And the dog is the father of them?" "Yes," he said, "I certainly saw him and the mother of the puppies come together." "And is he not yours?" "To be sure he is." "Then he is a father, and he is yours. Ergo, he is your father, and the puppies are your brothers." In a more serious vein, take the dialogue called The Sophist. This is a logical discussion of definition, which uses the sophist as an illustration. With its logic, we are not at present concerned. The only thing I wish to mention at the moment as regards this dialogue is the final conclusion. He, then, who traces the pedigree of his, the sophist's art, as follows. Who, belonging to the conscious or dissembling section of the art of causing self-contradiction, is an imitator of appearance, and is separated from the class of fantastic, which is a branch of image-making, into that further division of creation, the juggling of words, a creation human and not divine. Anyone who affirms the real sophist to be of this blood and lineage will say the very truth. There is a story about Protagoras, no doubt apocryphal, which illustrates the connection of the sophists with the law courts in the popular mind. It is said that he taught a young man on the terms that he should be paid his fee if the young man won his first lawsuit, but not otherwise, and that the young man's first lawsuit was one brought by Protagoras for recovery of his fee. However, it is time to leave these preliminaries and see what is really known about Protagoras. Protagoras was born about 500 BC at Abdera, the city from which Democritus came. He twice visited Athens, his second visit being not later than 432 BC. He made a code of laws for the city of Thurii in 444 to 3 BC. There is a tradition that he was prosecuted for impiety, but this seems to be untrue, in spite of the fact that he wrote a book, On the Gods, which began, "With regard to the gods, I cannot feel sure either that they are or that they are not, nor what they are like in figure. For there are many things that hinder sure knowledge, the obscurity of the subject, and the shortness of human life." His second visit to Athens is described somewhat satirically in Plato's Protagoras, and his doctrines are discussed seriously in the Theaetetus. He is chiefly noted for his doctrine that man is the measure of all things, of things that are that they are, and of things that are not that they are not. This is interpreted as meaning that each man is the measure of all things, and that when men differ, there is no objective truth in virtue of which one is right and the other wrong. The doctrine is essentially skeptical and is presumably based on the deceitfulness of the senses. One of the three founders of pragmatism, F.C.S. Schiller, was in the habit of calling himself a disciple of Protagoras. This was, I think, because Plato in the Theaetetus suggests, as an interpretation of Protagoras, that one opinion can be better than another, though it cannot be truer. For example, when a man has jaundice, everything looks yellow. There is no sense in saying that things are really not yellow, but the colour they look to a man in health. We can say, however, that since health is better than sickness, the opinion of the man in health is better than that of the man who has jaundice. This point of view, obviously, is akin to pragmatism. The disbelief in objective truth makes the majority, for practical purposes, the arbiters as to what to believe. Hence, Protagoras was led to a defense of law and convention and traditional morality. While, as we saw, he did not know whether the gods existed, he was sure they ought to be worshipped. This point of view is obviously the right one for a man whose theoretical skepticism is thoroughgoing and logical. Protagoras spent his adult life in a sort of perpetual lecture tour through the cities of Greece, teaching for a fee anyone who desired practical efficiency and higher mental culture. Zeller, page 1299. Plato objects, somewhat snobbishly, according to modern notions, to the sophist's practice of charging money for instruction. Plato himself had adequate private means and was unable, apparently, to realize the necessities of those who had not his good fortune. It is odd that modern professors, who see no reason to refuse a salary, have so frequently repeated Plato's strictures. There was, however, another point in which the sophists differed from most contemporary philosophers. It was usual, except among the sophists, for a teacher to found a school which had some of the properties of a brotherhood. There was a greater or smaller amount of common life. There was often something analogous to a monastic rule. And there was usually an esoteric doctrine not proclaimed to the public. All this was natural wherever philosophy had arisen out of Orphism. Among the sophists, there was none of this. What they had to teach was not in their minds connected with religion or virtue. They taught the art of arguing, and as much knowledge as would help in this art. Broadly speaking, they were prepared, like modern lawyers, to show how to argue for or against any opinion, and were not concerned to advocate conclusions of their own. Those to whom philosophy was a way of life, closely bound up with religion, were naturally shocked. To them, the sophists appeared frivolous and immoral. To some extent, though it is impossible to say how far, the odium which the sophists incurred, not only with the general public, but with Plato and subsequent philosophers, was due to their intellectual merit. The pursuit of truth, when it is wholehearted, must ignore moral considerations. We cannot know in advance that the truth will turn out to be what is thought edifying in a given society. The sophists were prepared to follow an argument wherever it might lead them. Often it led them to skepticism. One of them, Gorgias, maintained that nothing exists, that if anything exists, it is unknowable. And granting it even to exist and to be knowable by any one man, he could never communicate it to others. We do not know what his arguments were, but I can well imagine that they had a logical force which compelled his opponents to take refuge in edification. Plato is always concerned to advocate views that will make people what he thinks virtuous. He is hardly ever intellectually honest, because he allows himself to judge doctrines by their social consequences. Even about this he is not honest. He pretends to follow the argument and to be judging by purely theoretical standards, when in fact he is twisting the discussion so as to lead to a virtuous result. He introduced this vice into philosophy, where it has persisted ever since. It was probably largely hostility to the sophists that gave this character to his dialogues. One of the defects of all philosophers since Plato is that their inquiries into ethics proceed on the assumption that they already know the conclusions to be reached. It seems that there were men in the Athens of the late 5th century who taught political doctrines which seemed immoral to their contemporaries, and seem so to the democratic nations of the present day. Thrasymachus, in the first book of the Republic, argues that there is no justice except the interest of the stronger, that laws are made by governments for their own advantage, and that there is no impersonal standard to which to appeal in contests for power. Callicles, according to Plato, in the Gorgias, maintained a similar doctrine. The law of nature, he said, is the law of the stronger. But for convenience, men have established institutions and moral precepts to restrain the strong. Such doctrines have won much wider assent in our day than they did in antiquity, and whatever may be thought of them, they are not characteristic of the sophists. During the 5th century, whatever part the sophists may have had in the change, there was in Athens a transformation from a certain stiff Puritan simplicity to a quick-witted and rather cruel cynicism in conflict with a slow-witted and equally cruel defense of crumbling orthodoxy. At the beginning of the century comes the Athenian championship of the cities of Ionia against the Persians and the victory of Marathon in 490 BC. At the end comes the defeat of Athens by Sparta in 404 BC and the execution of Socrates in 399 BC. After this time, Athens ceased to be politically important, but acquired undoubted cultural supremacy, which it retained until the victory of Christianity. Something of the history of 5th century Athens is essential to the understanding of Plato and of all subsequent Greek thought. In the First Persian War, the chief glory went to the Athenians, owing to the decisive victory at Marathon. In the Second War, 10 years later, the Athenians still were the best of the Greeks at sea, but on land, victory was mainly due to the Spartans, who were the acknowledged leaders of the Hellenic world. The Spartans, however, were narrowly provincial in their outlook and ceased to oppose the Persians when they had been chased out of European Greece. The championship of the Asiatic Greeks and the liberation of the islands that had been conquered by the Persians was undertaken with great success by Athens. Athens became the leading sea power and acquired a considerable imperialist control over the Ionian islands. Under the leadership of Pericles, who was a moderate democrat and a moderate imperialist, Athens prospered. The great temples, whose ruins are still the glory of Athens, were built by his initiative to replace those destroyed by Xerxes. The city increased very rapidly in wealth and also in culture, and, as invariably happens at such times, particularly when wealth is due to foreign commerce, traditional morality and traditional beliefs decayed. There was, at this time in Athens, an extraordinarily large number of men of genius. The three great dramatists, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, all belong to the 5th century. Aeschylus fought at Marathon and saw the Battle of Salamis. Sophocles was still religiously orthodox. But Euripides was influenced by Protagoras and by the free-thinking spirit of the time, and his treatment of the myths is skeptical and subversive. Aristophanes, the comic poet, made fun of Socrates, sophists, and philosophers, but nevertheless belonged to their circle. In the Symposium, Plato represents him as on very friendly terms with Socrates. Phidias the sculptor, as we have seen, belonged to the circle of Pericles. The excellence of Athens at this period was artistic rather than intellectual. None of the great mathematicians or philosophers of the 5th century were Athenians, with the exception of Socrates. And Socrates was not a writer, but a man who confined himself to oral discussion. The outbreak of the Peloponnesian War in 431 BC and the death of Pericles in 429 BC introduced a darker period in Athenian history. The Athenians were superior at sea, but the Spartans had supremacy on land and repeatedly occupied Attica, except Athens, during the summer. The result was that Athens was overcrowded and suffered severely from the plague. In 414 BC, the Athenians sent a large expedition to Sicily in the hope of capturing Syracuse, which was allied with Sparta, but the attempt was a failure. War made the Athenians fierce and persecuting. In 416 BC, they conquered the island of Milos, put to death all men of military age, and enslaved the other inhabitants. The Trojan Women of Euripides is a protest against such barbarism. The conflict had an ideological aspect, since Sparta was the champion of oligarchy and Athens of democracy. The Athenians had reason to suspect some of their own aristocrats of treachery, which was generally thought to have had a part in the final naval defeat at the Battle of Aegospotami in 405 BC. At the end of the war, the Spartans established in Athens an oligarchical government known as the 30 Tyrants. Some of the 30, including Critias, their chief, had been pupils of Socrates. They were deservedly unpopular and were overthrown within a year. With the compliance of Sparta, democracy was restored, but it was an embittered democracy, precluded by an amnesty from direct vengeance against its internal enemies, but glad of any pretext not covered by the amnesty for prosecuting them. It was in this atmosphere that the trial and death of Socrates took place, 399 BC. Part 2. Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Chapter 11. Socrates. Socrates is a very difficult subject for the historian. There are many men concerning whom it is certain that very little is known, and other men concerning whom it is certain that a great deal is known. But in the case of Socrates, the uncertainty is as to whether we know very little or a great deal. He was undoubtedly an Athenian citizen of moderate means, who spent his time in disputation and taught philosophy to the young, but not for money, like the Sophists. He was certainly tried, condemned to death, and executed in 399 BC at about the age of 70. He was unquestionably a well-known figure in Athens, since Aristophanes caricatured him in the clouds. But beyond this point, we become involved in controversy. Two of his pupils, Xenophon and Plato, wrote voluminously about him, but they said very different things. Even when they agree, it has been suggested by Burnet that Xenophon is copying Plato. Where they disagree, some believe the one, some the other, some neither. In such a dangerous dispute, I shall not venture to take sides, but I will set out briefly the various points of view. Let us begin with Xenophon, a military man, not very liberally endowed with brains, and on the whole conventional in his outlook. Xenophon is pained that Socrates should have been accused of impiety and of corrupting the youth. He contends that, on the contrary, Socrates was eminently pious and had a thoroughly wholesome effect upon those who came under his influence. His ideas, it appears, so far from being subversive, were rather dull and commonplace. This defense goes too far, since it leaves the hostility to Socrates unexplained. As Burnet says, Thales to Plato, page 149, Xenophon's defense of Socrates is too successful. He would never have been put to death if he had been like that. There has been a tendency to think that everything Xenophon says must be true, because he had not the wits to think of anything untrue. This is a very invalid line of argument. A stupid man's report of what a clever man says is never accurate, because he unconsciously translates what he hears into something that he can understand. I would rather be reported by my bitterest enemy among philosophers than by a friend innocent of philosophy. We cannot therefore accept what Xenophon says if it either involves any difficult point in philosophy or is part of an argument to prove that Socrates was unjustly condemned. Nevertheless, some of Xenophon's reminiscences are very convincing. He tells, as Plato also does, how Socrates was continually occupied with the problem of getting competent men into positions of power. He would ask such questions as, "If I wanted a shoe mended, whom should I employ?" To which some ingenuous youth would answer, "A shoemaker, O Socrates." He would go on to carpenters, coppersmiths, etc., and finally ask some such question as, "Who should mend the ship of state?" When he fell into conflict with the 30 tyrants, Critias, their chief, who knew his ways from having studied under him, forbade him to continue teaching the young, and added, "You had better be done with your shoemakers, carpenters, and coppersmiths. These must be pretty well trodden out at heel by this time, considering the circulation you have given them." Xenophon, Memorabilia, Book 1, Chapter 2. This happened during the brief oligarchic government established by the Spartans at the end of the Peloponnesian War. But at most times, Athens was democratic, so much so that even generals were elected or chosen by lot. Socrates came across a young man who wished to become a general and persuaded him that it would be well to know something of the art of war. The young men accordingly went away and took a brief course in tactics. When he returned, Socrates, after some satirical praise, sent him back for further instruction. Same source, Book 3, Chapter 1. Another young man he set to learning the principles of finance. He tried the same sort of plan on many people, including the war minister, but it was decided that it was easier to silence him by means of the hemlock than to cure the evils of which he complained. With Plato's account of Socrates, the difficulty is quite a different one from what it is in the case of Xenophon, namely, that it is very hard to judge how far Plato means to portray the historical Socrates and how far he intends the person called Socrates in his dialogues to be merely the mouthpiece of his own opinions. Plato, in addition to being a philosopher, is an imaginative writer of great genius and charm. No one supposes, and he himself does not seriously pretend, that the conversations in his dialogues took place just as he records them. Nevertheless, at any rate in the earlier dialogues, the conversation is completely natural, and the characters quite convincing. It is the excellence of Plato as a writer of fiction that throws doubt on him as a historian. His Socrates is a consistent and extraordinarily interesting character, far beyond the power of most men to invent. But I think Plato could have invented him. Whether he did so is, of course, another question. The dialogue which is most generally regarded as historical is the Apology. This professes to be the speech that Socrates made in his own defense at his trial, not, of course, a stenographic report, but what remained in Plato's memory some years after the event, put together and elaborated with literary art. Plato was present at the trial, and it certainly seems fairly clear that what is set down is the sort of thing that Plato remembered Socrates as saying, and that the intention is, broadly speaking, historical. This, with all its limitations, is enough to give a fairly definite picture of the character of Socrates. The main facts of the trial of Socrates are not open to doubt. The prosecution was based upon the charge that Socrates is an evildoer and a curious person, searching into things under the earth and above the heaven, and making the worse appear the better cause, and teaching all this to others. The real ground of hostility to him was almost certainly that he was supposed to be connected with the aristocratic party. Most of his pupils belonged to this faction, and some, in positions of power, had proved themselves very pernicious. But this ground could not be made evident on account of the amnesty. He was found guilty by a majority, and it was then open to him, by Athenian law, to propose some lesser penalty than death. The judges had to choose, if they had found the accused guilty, between the penalty demanded by the prosecution and that suggested by the defence. It was therefore to the interest of Socrates to suggest a substantial penalty which the court might have accepted as adequate. He, however, proposed a fine of 30 minae, for which some of his friends, including Plato, were willing to go surety. This was so small a punishment that the court was annoyed and condemned him to death by a larger majority than that which had found him guilty. Undoubtedly, he foresaw this result. It is clear that he had no wish to avoid the death penalty by concessions which might seem to acknowledge his guilt. The prosecutors were Anytus, a democratic politician, Meletus, a tragic poet, youthful and unknown, with lanky hair and scanty beard and hooked nose, and Lycon, an obscure rhetorician. See Burnet, Thales to Plato, page 180. They maintained that Socrates was guilty of not worshipping the gods the state worshipped, but introducing other new divinities, and further, that he was guilty of corrupting the young by teaching them accordingly. Without further troubling ourselves with the insoluble question of the relation of the Platonic Socrates to the real man, let us see what Plato makes him say in answer to this charge. Socrates begins by accusing his prosecutors of eloquence and rebutting the charge of eloquence as applied to himself. The only eloquence of which he is capable, he says, is that of truth, and they must not be angry with him if he speaks in his accustomed manner, not in a set oration duly ornamented with words and phrases. Footnote. In quotations from Plato, I have used Jowett's translation. End of footnote. He is over 70 and has never appeared in a court of law until now. They must therefore pardon his unforensic way of speaking. He goes on to say that, in addition to his formal accusers, he has a large body of informal accusers, who, ever since the judges were children, have gone about telling of one Socrates, a wise man who speculated about the heavens above, and searched into the earth beneath, and made the worse appear the better cause. Such men, he says, are supposed not to believe in the existence of the gods. This old accusation by public opinion is more dangerous than the formal indictment, the more so as he does not know who are the men from whom it comes, except in the case of Aristophanes. Footnote. In the Clouds, Socrates is represented as denying the existence of Zeus. End of footnote. He points out, in reply to these older grounds of hostility, that he is not a man of science. I have nothing to do with physical speculations. That he is not a teacher and does not take money for teaching. He goes on to make fun of the sophists and to disclaim the knowledge that they profess to have. What then is the reason why I am called wise and have such an evil fame? The oracle of Delphi, it appears, was once asked if there were any man wiser than Socrates, and replied that there was not. Socrates professes to have been completely puzzled, since he knew nothing, and yet a god cannot lie. He therefore went about among men reputed wise to see whether he could convict the god of error. First he went to a politician who was thought wise by many and still wiser by himself. He soon found that the man was not wise, and explained this to him kindly but firmly. And the consequence was that he hated me. He then went to the poets and asked them to explain passages in their writings, but they were unable to do so. Then I knew that not by wisdom do poets write poetry, but by a sort of genius and inspiration. Then he went to the artisans, but found them equally disappointing. In the process, he says, he made many dangerous enemies. Finally, he concluded that God only is wise, and by his answer he intends to show that the wisdom of men is worth little or nothing. He is not speaking of Socrates, he is only using my name by way of illustration, as if he said, He, O man, is the wisest who, like Socrates, knows that his wisdom is in truth worth nothing. This business of showing up pretenders to wisdom takes up all his time and has left him in utter poverty, but he feels it a duty to vindicate the oracle. Young men of the richer classes, he says, having not much to do, enjoy listening to him, exposing people, and proceed to do likewise, thus increasing the number of his enemies. For they do not like to confess that their pretense of knowledge has been detected. So much for the first class of accusers. Socrates now proceeds to examine his prosecutor Meletus, that good man and true lover of his country, as he calls himself. He asks, who are the people who improve the young? Meletus first mentions the judges, then under pressure is driven step by step to say that every Athenian, except Socrates, improves the young, whereupon Socrates congratulates the city on its good fortune. Next, he points out that good men are better to live among than bad men, and therefore he cannot be so foolish as to corrupt his fellow citizens intentionally. But if unintentionally, then Meletus should instruct him, not prosecute him. The indictment had said that Socrates not only denied the gods of the state, but introduced other gods of his own. Meletus, however, says that Socrates is a complete atheist, and adds, he says that the sun is stone and the moon earth. Socrates replies that Meletus seems to think he is prosecuting Anaxagoras, whose views may be heard in the theatre for one drachma, presumably in the plays of Euripides. Socrates, of course, points out that this new accusation of complete atheism contradicts the indictment and then passes on to more general considerations. The rest of the apology is essentially religious in tone. He has been a soldier and has remained at his post as he was ordered to do. Now, God orders me to fulfill the philosopher's mission of searching into myself and other men, and it would be as shameful to desert his post now as in time of battle. Fear of death is not wisdom, since no one knows whether death may not be the greater good. If he were offered his life on condition of ceasing to speculate, as he has done hitherto, he would reply, Men of Athens, I honour and love you, but I shall obey God rather than you. Footnote. Compare Acts chapter 5, verse 29. End footnote. And while I have life and strength, I shall never cease from the practice and teaching of philosophy, exhorting any one whom I meet. For know that this is the command of God, and I believe that no greater good has ever happened in the state than my service to the God. He goes on, I have something more to say, at which you may be inclined to cry out, but I believe that to hear me will be good for you, and therefore I beg that you will not cry out. I would have you know that if you kill such a one as I am, you will injure yourselves more than you will injure me. Nothing will injure me, not Meletus, nor yet Anytus. They cannot, for a bad man is not permitted to injure a better than himself. I do not deny that Anytus may perhaps kill him, or drive him into exile, or deprive him of civil rights. And he may imagine, and others may imagine, that he is inflicting a great injury upon him. But there I do not agree. For the evil of doing as he is doing, the evil of unjustly taking away the life of another, is greater far. It is for the sake of his judges, he says, not for his own sake that he is pleading. He is a gadfly, given to the state by God, and it will not be easy to find another like him. I dare say you may feel out of temper, like a person who is suddenly awakened from sleep, and you think that you might easily strike me dead, as Anytus advises, and then you would sleep on for the remainder of your lives, unless God, in his care of you, sent you another gadfly. Why has he only gone about in private and not given advice on public affairs? You have heard me speak at sundry times, and in divers places, of an oracle or sign which comes to me, and is the divinity which Meletus ridicules in the indictment. This sign, which is a kind of voice, first began to come to me when I was a child. It always forbids, but never commands me to do anything which I am going to do. This is what deters me from being a politician. He goes on to say that in politics, no honest man can live long. He gives two instances in which he was unavoidably mixed up in public affairs. In the first, he resisted the democracy. In the second, the 30 tyrants. In each case, when the authorities were acting illegally. He points out that among those present are many former pupils of his, and fathers and brothers of pupils. Not one of these has been produced by the prosecution to testify that he corrupts the young. This is almost the only argument in the apology that a lawyer for the defense would sanction. He refuses to follow the custom of producing his weeping children in court to soften the hearts of the judges. Such scenes, he says, make the accused and the city alike ridiculous. It is his business to convince the judges, not to ask a favor of them. After the verdict, and the rejection of the alternative penalty of 30 minae, in connection with which Socrates names Plato as one among his sureties and present in court, he makes one final speech. And now, O men who have condemned me, I would fain prophesy to you, for I am about to die, and in the hour of death men are gifted with prophetic power. And I prophesy to you, who are my murderers, that immediately after my departure, punishment far heavier than you have inflicted on me will surely await you. If you think that by killing men you can prevent someone from censuring your evil lives, you are mistaken. That is not a way of escape which is either possible or honorable. The easiest and the noblest way is not to be disabling others, but to be improving yourselves. He then turns to those of his judges who have voted for acquittal, and tells them that, in all that he has done that day, his oracle has never opposed him, though on other occasions it has often stopped him in the middle of a speech. This, he says, is an intimation that what has happened to me is a good, and that those of us who think death is an evil are in error. For either death is a dreamless sleep, which is plainly good, or the soul migrates to another world. And what would not a man give if he might converse with Orpheus and Musaeus and Hesiod and Homer? Nay, if this be true, let me die and die again. In the next world, he will converse with others who have suffered death unjustly, and above all, he will continue his search after knowledge. In another world, they do not put a man to death for asking questions, assuredly not. For besides being happier than we are, they will be immortal, if what is said is true. The hour of departure has arrived, and we go our ways, I to die and you to live. Which is better, God only knows. The apology gives a clear picture of a man of a certain type, a man very sure of himself, high-minded, indifferent to worldly success, believing that he is guided by a divine voice, and persuaded that clear thinking is the most important requisite for right living. Except in this last point, he resembles a Christian martyr or a Puritan. In the final passage, where he considers what happens after death, it is impossible not to feel that he firmly believes in immortality, and that his professed uncertainty is only assumed. He is not troubled, like the Christians, by fears of eternal torment. He has no doubt that his life in the next world will be a happy one. In the Phaedo, the Platonic Socrates gives reasons for the belief in immortality. Whether these were the reasons that influenced the historical Socrates, it is impossible to say. There seems hardly any doubt that the historical Socrates claimed to be guided by an oracle, or daimon. Whether this was analogous to what a Christian would call the voice of conscience, or whether it appeared to him as an actual voice, it is impossible to know. Joan of Arc was inspired by voices, which are a common form of insanity. Socrates was liable to cataleptic trances. At least, that seems the natural explanation of such an incident as occurred once when he was on military service. One morning, he was thinking about something which he could not resolve. He would not give it up, but continued thinking from early dawn until noon. There he stood, fixed in thought. And at noon attention was drawn to him, and the rumor ran through the wondering crowd that Socrates had been standing and thinking about something ever since the break of day. At last, in the evening after supper, some Ionians out of curiosity, I should explain that this occurred not in winter but in summer, brought out their mats and slept in the open air, that they might watch him and see whether he would stand all night. There he stood until the following morning, and with the return of light he offered up a prayer to the sun and went his way. Symposium 220. This sort of thing, in a lesser degree, was a common occurrence with Socrates. At the beginning of the symposium, Socrates and Aristodemus go together to the banquet, but Socrates drops behind in a fit of abstraction. When Aristodemus arrives, Agathon, the host, says, "What have you done with Socrates?" Aristodemus is astonished to find Socrates not with him. A slave is sent to look for him, and finds him in the portico of a neighboring house. "There he is fixed," says the slave on his return, "and when I call to him, he will not stir." Those who know him well explain that he has a way of stopping anywhere and losing himself without any reason. They leave him alone, and he enters when the feast is half over. Everyone is agreed that Socrates was very ugly. He had a snub nose and a considerable paunch. He was uglier than all the Silenuses in the satiric drama. Xenophon, Symposium. He was always dressed in shabby old clothes and went barefoot everywhere. His indifference to heat and cold, hunger and thirst, amazed everyone. Alcibiades, in the Symposium describing Socrates on military service, says, "His endurance was simply marvelous, when, being cut off from our supplies, we were compelled to go without food. On such occasions, which often happen in time of war, he was superior not only to me, but to everybody. There was no one to be compared to him. His fortitude in enduring cold was also surprising. There was a severe frost, for the winter in that region is really tremendous, and everybody else either remained indoors, or if they went out, had on an amazing quantity of clothes, and were well shod, and had their feet swathed in felt and fleeces. In the midst of this, Socrates, with his bare feet on the ice, and in his ordinary dress, marched better than the other soldiers who had shoes, and they looked daggers at him because he seemed to despise them." His mastery over all bodily passions is constantly stressed. He seldom drank wine, but when he did, he could outdrink anybody. No one had ever seen him drunk. In love, even under the strongest temptations, he remained platonic, if Plato is speaking the truth. He was the perfect Orphic saint. In the dualism of heavenly soul and earthly body, he had achieved the complete mastery of the soul over the body. His indifference to death at the last is the final proof of this mastery. At the same time, he is not an orthodox Orphic. It is only the fundamental doctrines that he accepts, not the superstitions and ceremonies of purification. The Platonic Socrates anticipates both the Stoics and the Cynics. The Stoics held that the supreme good is virtue, and that a man cannot be deprived of virtue by outside causes. This doctrine is implicit in the contention of Socrates that his judges cannot harm him. The Cynics despised worldly goods, and showed their contempt by eschewing the comforts of civilization. This is the same point of view that led Socrates to go barefoot and ill-clad. It seems fairly certain that the preoccupations of Socrates were ethical rather than scientific. In the Apology, as we saw, he says, "I have nothing to do with physical speculations." The earliest of the Platonic dialogues, which are generally supposed to be the most Socratic, are mainly occupied with the search for definitions of ethical terms. The Charmides is concerned with the definition of temperance or moderation, the Lysis with friendship, the Laches with courage. In all of these, no conclusion is arrived at, but Socrates makes it clear that he thinks it important to examine such questions. The Platonic Socrates consistently maintains that he knows nothing, and is only wiser than others in knowing that he knows nothing. but he does not think knowledge unobtainable. On the contrary, he thinks the search for knowledge of the utmost importance. He maintains that no man sins wittingly, and therefore only knowledge is needed to make all men perfectly virtuous. The close connection between virtue and knowledge is characteristic of Socrates and Plato. To some degree, it exists in all Greek thought, as opposed to that of Christianity. In Christian ethics, a pure heart is the essential, and is at least as likely to be found among the ignorant as among the learned. This difference between Greek and Christian ethics has persisted down to the present day. Dialectic, that is to say, the method of seeking knowledge by question and answer, was not invented by Socrates. It seems to have been first practiced systematically by Zeno, the disciple of Parmenides. In Plato's dialogue, Parmenides, Zeno subjects Socrates to the same kind of treatment to which, elsewhere in Plato, Socrates subjects others. But there is every reason to suppose that Socrates practiced and developed the method. As we saw, when Socrates is condemned to death, he reflects happily that in the next world he can go on asking questions forever, and cannot be put to death, as he will be immortal. Certainly, if he practiced dialectic in the way described in the Apology, the hostility to him is easily explained. All the humbugs in Athens would combine against him. The dialectic method is suitable for some questions and unsuitable for others. Perhaps this helped to determine the character of Plato's inquiries, which were, for the most part, such as could be dealt with in this way. And through Plato's influence, most subsequent philosophy has been bounded by the limitations resulting from his method. Some matters are obviously unsuitable for treatment in this way, empirical science, for example. It is true that Galileo used dialogues to advocate his theories, but that was only in order to overcome prejudice. The positive grounds for his discoveries could not be inserted in a dialogue without great artificiality. Socrates, in Plato's works, always pretends that he is only eliciting knowledge already possessed by the man he is questioning. On this ground, he compares himself to a midwife. When, in the Phaedo and the Meno, he applies his method to geometrical problems, he has to ask leading questions, which any judge would disallow. The method is in harmony with the doctrine of reminiscence, according to which we learn by remembering what we knew in a former existence. As against this view, consider any discovery that has been made by means of the microscope, say the spread of diseases by bacteria. It can hardly be maintained that such knowledge can be elicited from a previously ignorant person by the method of question and answer. The matters that are suitable for treatment by the Socratic method are those as to which we have already enough knowledge to come to a right conclusion, but have failed, through confusion of thought or lack of analysis, to make the best logical use of what we know. A question such as, what is justice, is eminently suited for discussion in a Platonic dialogue. We all freely use the words just and unjust, and by examining the ways in which we use them, we can arrive inductively at the definition that will best suit with usage. All that is needed is knowledge of how the words in question are used. But when our inquiry is concluded, we have made only a linguistic discovery, not a discovery in ethics. We can, however, apply the method profitably to a somewhat larger class of cases. Wherever what is being debated is logical rather than factual, discussion is a good method of eliciting truth. Suppose someone maintains, for example, that democracy is good, but persons holding certain opinions should not be allowed to vote. We may convict him of inconsistency and prove to him that at least one of his two assertions must be more or less erroneous. Logical errors are, I think, of greater practical importance than many people believe. They enable their perpetrators to hold the comfortable opinion on every subject in turn. Any logically coherent body of doctrine is sure to be in part painful and contrary to current prejudices. The dialectic method, or more generally, the habit of unfettered discussion, tends to promote logical consistency and is in this way useful. But it is quite unavailing when the object is to discover new facts. Perhaps philosophy might be defined as the sum total of those inquiries that can be pursued by Plato's methods. But if this definition is appropriate, that is because of Plato's influence upon subsequent philosophers. Chapter 12. The Influence of Sparta. To understand Plato, and indeed many later philosophers, it is necessary to know something of Sparta. Sparta had a double effect on Greek thought, through the reality and through the myth. Each is important. The reality enabled the Spartans to defeat Athens in war. The myth influenced Plato's political theory and that of countless subsequent writers. The myth, fully developed, is to be found in Plutarch's Life of Lycurgus. The ideals that it favors have had a great part in framing the doctrines of Rousseau, Nietzsche, and National Socialism. Footnote. Not to mention Dr. Thomas Arnold and the English public schools. End of footnote. The myth is of even more importance, historically, than the reality. Nevertheless, we will begin with the latter, for the reality was the source of the myth. Laconia, or Lacedaemon, of which Sparta was the capital, occupied the southeast of the Peloponnesus. The Spartans, who were the ruling race, had conquered the country at the time of the Dorian invasion from the north, and had reduced the population that they found there to the condition of serfs. These serfs were called Helots. In historical times, all the land belonged to the Spartans, who, however, were forbidden by law and custom to cultivate it themselves, both on the ground that such labor was degrading and in order that they might always be free for military service. The serfs were not bought and sold, but remained attached to the land, which was divided into lots, one or more for each adult male Spartan. These lots, like the Helots, could not be bought or sold, and passed by law from father to son. They could, however, be bequeathed. The landowner received from the Helot who cultivated the lot 70 medimni, about 105 bushels, of grain for himself, 12 for his wife, and a stated portion of wine and fruit annually. Footnote. It seems that Spartan men ate nearly 6 times as much as their wives. End of footnote. Anything beyond this amount was the property of the Helot. The Helots were Greeks, like the Spartans, and bitterly resented their servile condition. When they could, they rebelled. The Spartans had a body of secret police to deal with this danger, but to supplement this precaution, they had another. Once a year, they declared war on the Helots, so that their young men could kill any who seemed insubordinate without incurring the legal guilt of homicide. Helots could be emancipated by the state, but not by their masters. They were emancipated rather rarely for exceptional bravery in battle. At some time during the 8th century BC, the Spartans conquered the neighboring country of Messenia and reduced most of its inhabitants to the condition of Helots. There had been a lack of Lebensraum in Sparta, but the new territory for a time removed this source of discontent. Lots were for the common run of Spartans. The aristocracy had estates of their own, whereas the lots were portions of common land assigned by the state. The free inhabitants of other parts of Laconia, called Perioeci, had no share of political power. The sole business of a Spartan citizen was war, to which he was trained from birth. Sickly children were exposed after inspection by the heads of the tribe. Only those judged vigorous were allowed to be reared. Up to the age of 20, all the boys were trained in one big school. The purpose of the training was to make them hardy, indifferent to pain, and submissive to discipline. There was no nonsense about cultural or scientific education. The sole aim was to produce good soldiers, wholly devoted to the state. At the age of 20, actual military service began. Marriage was permitted to anyone over the age of 20, but until the age of 30, a man had to live in the men's house, and had to manage his marriage as if it were an illicit and secret affair. After 30, he was a full-fledged citizen. Every citizen belonged to a mess and dined with the other members. He had to make a contribution in kind from the produce of his lot. It was the theory of the state that no Spartan citizen should be destitute and none should be rich. Each was expected to live on the produce of his lot, which he could not alienate except by free gift. None was allowed to own gold or silver, and the money was made of iron. Spartan simplicity became proverbial. The position of women in Sparta was peculiar. They were not secluded like respectable women elsewhere in Greece. Girls went through the same physical training as was given to boys. What is more remarkable, boys and girls did their gymnastics together, all being naked. It was desired, I quote Plutarch's Lycurgus in North's translation, that the maidens should harden their bodies with exercise of running, wrestling, throw the bar, and casting the dart, to the end that the fruit wherewith they might be afterwards conceived, taking nourishment of a strong and lusty body, should shoot out and spread the better, and that they, by gathering strength thus by exercises, should more easily away with the pains of childbearing. And though the maidens did show themselves thus naked openly, yet was there no dishonesty seen nor offered, but all this sport was full of play and toys, without any youthful part or wantonness. Men who would not marry were made infamous by law, and compelled, even in the coldest weather, to walk up and down naked outside the place where the young people were doing their exercises and dances. Women were not allowed to exhibit any emotion not profitable to the state. They might display contempt for a coward, and would be praised if he were their son, but they might not show grief if their newborn child was condemned to death as a weakling, or if their sons were killed in battle. They were considered by other Greeks exceptionally chaste. At the same time, a childless married woman would raise no objection if the state ordered her to find out whether some other man would be more successful than her husband in begetting citizens. Children were encouraged by legislation. According to Aristotle, the father of three sons was exempt from military service, and the father of four from all the burdens of the state. The constitution of Sparta was complicated. There were two kings, belonging to two different families, and succeeding by heredity. One or other of the kings commanded the army in time of war, but in time of peace their powers were limited. At communal feasts they got twice as much to eat as anyone else, and there was general mourning when one of them died. They were members of the Council of Elders, a body consisting of 30 men, including the kings. The other 28 must be over 60, and were chosen for life by the whole body of the citizens, but only from aristocratic families. The council tried criminal cases and prepared matters which were to come before the assembly. This body, the assembly, consisted of all the citizens. It could not initiate anything, but could vote yes or no to any proposal brought before it. No law could be enacted without its consent. But its consent, though necessary, was not sufficient. The elders and magistrates must proclaim the decision before it became valid. In addition to the kings, the council of elders and the assembly, there was a fourth branch of the government, peculiar to Sparta. This was the five ephors. These were chosen out of the whole body of the citizens by a method which Aristotle says was too childish, and which Berry says was virtually by lot. They were a democratic element in the constitution, apparently intended to balance the kings. Footnote. In speaking of democratic elements in the Spartan constitution, one must of course remember that the citizens as a whole were a ruling class fiercely tyrannizing over the helots, and allowing no power to the perioeci. End of footnote. Every month the kings swore to uphold the constitution, and the ephors then swore to uphold the kings, so long as they remained true to their oath. When either king went on a warlike expedition, two ephors accompanied him to watch over his behavior. The ephors were the supreme civil court, but over the kings they had criminal jurisdiction. The Spartan constitution was supposed in later antiquity to have been due to a legislator named Lycurgus, who was said to have promulgated his laws in 885 BC. In fact, the Spartan system grew up gradually, and Lycurgus was a mythical person, originally a god. His name meant wolf repeller, and his origin was Arcadian. Sparta aroused among the other Greeks an admiration which is to us somewhat surprising. Originally, it had been much less different from other Greek cities than it became later. In early days, it produced poets and artists as good as those elsewhere. But about the 7th century BC, or perhaps even later, its constitution, falsely attributed to Lycurgus, crystallized into the form we have been considering. Everything else was sacrificed to success in war, and Sparta ceased to have any part whatever in what Greece contributed to the civilization of the world. To us, the Spartan state appears as a model, in miniature, of the state that the Nazis would establish if victorious. To the Greeks it seemed otherwise. As Berry says, "A stranger from Athens on Miletus in the 5th century, visiting the straggling villages which formed her unwalled, unpretentious city, must have had a feeling of being transported into an age long past, when men were braver, better, and simpler, unspoiled by wealth, undisturbed by ideas." To a philosopher like Plato, speculating in political science, the Spartan state seemed the nearest approach to the ideal. The ordinary Greek looked upon it as a structure of severe and simple beauty, a Dorian city stately as a Dorian temple, far nobler than his own abode, but not so comfortable to dwell in. One reason for the admiration felt for Sparta by other Greeks was its stability. All other Greek cities had revolutions, but the Spartan constitution remained unchanged for centuries, except for a gradual increase in the power of the ephors, which occurred by legal means without violence. It cannot be denied that for a long period the Spartans were successful in their main purpose, the creation of a race of invincible warriors. The Battle of Thermopylae, 480 BC, though technically a defeat, is perhaps the best example of their valor. Thermopylae was a narrow pass through the mountains where it was hoped that the Persian army could be held. 300 Spartans, with auxiliaries, repulsed all frontal attacks. But at last the Persians discovered a detour through the hills and succeeded in attacking the Greeks on both sides at once. Every single Spartan was killed at his post. Two men had been absent on sick leave, suffering from a disease of the eyes amounting almost to temporary blindness. One of them insisted on being led by his helot to the battle, where he perished. The other, Aristodemus, decided that he was too ill to fight and remained absent. When he returned to Sparta, no one would speak to him. He was called the coward Aristodemus. A year later, he wiped out his disgrace by dying bravely at the Battle of Plataea, where the Spartans were victorious. After the war, the Spartans erected a memorial on the battlefield of Thermopylae, saying only, "Stranger, tell the Lacedaemonians that we lie here in obedience to their orders." For a long time, the Spartans proved themselves invincible on land. They retained their supremacy until the year 371 BC, when they were defeated by the Thebans at the Battle of Leuctra. This was the end of their military greatness. Apart from war, the reality of Sparta was never quite the same as the theory. Herodotus, who lived at its great period, remarks, surprisingly, that no Spartan could resist a bribe. This was in spite of the fact that contempt for riches and love of the simple life was one of the main things inculcated in Spartan education. We are told that the Spartan women were chaste, yet it happened several times that a reputed heir to the kingship was set aside on the ground of not being the son of his mother's husband. We are told that the Spartans were inflexibly patriotic, yet the king, Pausanias, the victor of Plataea, ended as a traitor in the pay of Xerxes. Apart from such flagrant matters, the policy of Sparta was always petty and provincial. When Athens liberated the Greeks of Asia Minor and the adjacent islands from the Persians, Sparta held aloof. So long as the Peloponnesus was deemed safe, the fate of other Greeks was a matter of indifference. Every attempt at a confederation of the Hellenic world was defeated by Spartan particularism. Aristotle, who lived after the downfall of Sparta, gives a very hostile account of its constitution. What he says is so different from what other people say that it is difficult to believe he is speaking of the same place. For example, the legislator wanted to make the whole state hardy and temperate, and he has carried out his intention in the case of men, but he has neglected the women, who live in every sort of intemperance and luxury. The consequence is that in such a state wealth is too highly valued, especially if the citizens fall under the dominion of their wives, after the manner of most warlike races. Even in regard to courage, which is of no use in daily life and is needed only in war, the influence of the Lacedaemonian women has been most mischievous. This license of the Lacedaemonian women existed from the earliest times, and was only what might be expected. For, when Lycurgus, as tradition says, wanted to bring the women under his laws, they resisted, and he gave up the attempt. He goes on to accuse Spartans of avarice, which he attributes to the unequal distribution of property. Although lots cannot be sold, he says, they can be given or bequeathed. 2/5 of all the land, he adds, belongs to women. The consequence is a great diminution in the number of citizens. It is said that once there were 10,000, but at the time of the defeat by Thebes there were less than 1,000. Aristotle criticizes every point of the Spartan constitution. He says that the ephors are often very poor and therefore easy to bribe, and the power is so great that even kings are compelled to court them, so that the constitution has been turned into a democracy. The ephors, we are told, have too much license and live in a manner contrary to the spirit of the constitution, while the strictness in relation to ordinary citizens is so intolerable that they take refuge in the secret illegal indulgence of sensual pleasures. Aristotle wrote when Sparta was decadent, but on some points he expressly says that the evil he is mentioning has existed from early times. His tone is so dry and realistic that it is difficult to disbelieve him, and it is in line with all modern experience of the results of excessive severity in the laws. But it was not Aristotle's Sparta that persisted in men's imaginations. It was the mythical Sparta of Plutarch and the philosophic idealization of Sparta in Plato's Republic. Century after century, young men read these works and were fired with the ambition to become Lycurguses or philosopher kings. The resulting union of idealism and love of power has led men astray over and over again and is still doing so in the present day. The myth of Sparta, for medieval and modern readers, was mainly fixed by Plutarch. When he wrote, Sparta belonged to the romantic past. Its great period was as far removed from his time as Columbus is from ours. What he says must be treated with great caution by the historian of institutions, but by the historian of myth, it is of the utmost importance. Greece has influenced the world always through its effect on men's imaginations, ideals, and hopes, not directly through political power. Rome made roads, which largely still survive, and laws, which are the source of many modern legal codes. But it was the armies of Rome that made these things important. The Greeks, though admirable fighters, made no conquests, because they expended their military fury mainly on each other. It was left to the semi-barbarian Alexander to spread Hellenism throughout the Near East, and to make Greek the literary language in Egypt and Syria and the inland parts of Asia Minor. The Greeks could never have accomplished this task, not for lack of military force, but owing to their incapacity for political cohesion. The political vehicles of Hellenism have always been non-Hellenic. But it was the Greek genius that so inspired alien nations as to cause them to spread the culture of those whom they had conquered. What is important to the historian of the world is not the petty wars between Greek cities or the sordid squabbles for party ascendancy, but the memories retained by mankind when the brief episode was ended, like the recollection of a brilliant sunrise in the Alps, while the mountaineer struggles through an arduous day of wind and snow. These memories, as they gradually faded, left in men's minds the images of certain peaks that had shone with peculiar brightness in the early light, keeping alive the knowledge that behind the clouds a splendor still survived and might at any moment become manifest. Of these, Plato was the most important in early Christianity, Aristotle in the medieval church. But when, after the Renaissance, men began to value political freedom, it was above all to Plutarch that they turned. He influenced profoundly the English and French liberals of the 18th century and the founders of the United States. He influenced the Romantic movement in Germany and has continued, mainly by indirect channels, to influence German thought down to the present day. In some ways, his influence was good, in some, bad. As regards Lycurgus and Sparta, it was bad. What he has to say about Lycurgus is important, and I shall give a brief account of it, even at the cost of some repetition. Lycurgus, so Plutarch says, having resolved to give laws to Sparta, travelled widely in order to study different institutions. He liked the laws of Crete, which were very straight and severe, but disliked those of Ionia, where there were superfluities and vanities. Footnote: in quoting Plutarch, I use North's translation. End of footnote. In Egypt, he learned the advantage of separating the soldiers from the rest of the people, and afterwards, having returned from his travels, brought the practice of it into Sparta, where, setting the merchants, artificers, and labourers, everyone apart by themselves, he did establish a noble commonwealth. He made an equal division of lands among all the citizens of Sparta, in order to banish out of the city all insolvency, envy, covetousness, and deliciousness, and also all riches and poverty. He forbade gold and silver money, allowing only iron coinage, of so little value that, to lay up thereof the value of 10 minas, it would have occupied a whole cellar in a house. By this means he banished all superfluous and unprofitable sciences, since there was not enough money to pay their practitioners, and by the same law he made all external commerce impossible. Rhetoricians, panders, and jewellers, not liking the iron money, avoided Sparta. He next ordained that all the citizens should eat together, and all should have the same food. Lycurgus, like other reformers, thought the education of children the chiefest and greatest matter that a reformer of laws should establish. And like all who aim chiefly at military power, he was anxious to keep up the birth rate. The plays, sports, and dances the maids did naked before young men were provocations to draw and allure the young men to marry, not as persuaded by geometrical reasons, as saith Plato, but brought to it by liking and of very love. The habit of treating a marriage for the first few years as if it were a clandestine affair continued in both parties a still burning love and a new desire of the one to the other. Such, at least, is the opinion of Plutarch. He goes on to explain that a man was not thought ill of if, being old and having a young wife, he allowed a younger man to have children by her. It was lawful also for an honest man that loved another man's wife to entreat her husband to suffer him to lie with her, and that he might also plough in that lusty ground and cast abroad the seed of well-favoured children. There was to be no foolish jealousy, for Lycurgus did not like that children should be private to any men, but that they should be common to the common weal, by which reason he would also, that such as should become citizens should not be begotten of every man, but of the most honest men only. He goes on to explain that this is the principle that farmers apply to their livestock. When a child was born, the father brought him before the elders of his family to be examined. If he was healthy, he was given back to the father to be reared. If not, he was thrown into a deep pit of water. Children from the first were subjected to a severe hardening process, in some respects good. For example, they were not put in swaddling clothes. At the age of 7, boys were taken away from home and put in a boarding school, where they were divided into companies, each under the orders of one of their number, chosen for sense and courage. Touching learning, they had as much as served their turn, for the rest of their time they spent in learning how to obey, to away with pain, to endure labour, to overcome still in fight. They played naked together most of the time. After 12 years old, they wore no coats. They were always nasty and sluttish, and they never bathed except on certain days in the year. They slept on beds of straw, which in winter they mixed with thistle. They were taught to steal and were punished if caught, not for stealing, but for stupidity. Homosexual love, both male and female, was a recognized custom in Sparta, and had an acknowledged part in the education of adolescent boys. A boy's lover suffered credit or discredit by the boy's actions. Plutarch states that once, when a boy cried out because he was hurt in fighting, his lover was fined for the boy's cowardice. There was little liberty at any stage in the life of a Spartan. Their discipline and order of life continued still, after they were full-grown men, for it was not lawful for any man to live as he listed, but they were within their city as if they had been in a camp, where every man knoweth what allowance he hath to live withal, and what business he hath else to do in his calling. To be short, they were all of this mind, that they were not born to serve themselves, but to serve their country. One of the best and happiest things which Lycurgus ever brought into his city was the great rest and leisure which he made his citizens to have, only forbidding them that they should not profess any vile or base occupation. And they needed not also to be careful to get great riches, in a place where goods were nothing profitable nor esteemed. For the helots, which were bondmen made by the wars, did till their grounds, and yielded them a certain revenue every year. Plutarch goes on to tell a story of an Athenian condemned for idleness, upon hearing of which a Spartan exclaimed, "Show me the man condemned for living nobly and like a gentleman." Lycurgus, Plutarch continues, did accustom his citizens so that they neither would nor could live alone, but were in manner as men incorporated one with another, and were always in company together, as the bees be about their master bee. Spartans were not allowed to travel, nor were foreigners admitted to Sparta, except on business, for it was feared that alien customs would corrupt Lacedaemonian virtue. Plutarch relates the law that allowed Spartans to kill helots whenever they felt so disposed, but refuses to believe that anything so abominable can have been due to Lycurgus. "For I cannot be persuaded that ever Lycurgus invented or instituted so wicked and mischievous an act as that kind of ordinance was, because I imagine his nature was gentle and merciful by the clemency and justice we see he used in all his other doings." Except in this matter, Plutarch has nothing but praise for the constitution of Sparta. The effect of Sparta on Plato, with whom at the moment we shall be specially concerned, will be evident from the account of his Utopia, which will occupy the next chapter. Chapter 13. The Sources of Plato's Opinions. Plato and Aristotle were the most influential of all philosophers, ancient, medieval, or modern. And of the two, it was Plato who had the greater effect upon subsequent ages. I say this for two reasons. First, that Aristotle himself is an outcome of Plato. Second, that Christian theology and philosophy, at any rate until the 13th century, was much more Platonic than Aristotelian. It is necessary, therefore, in a history of philosophic thought, to treat Plato, and to a lesser degree Aristotle, more fully than any of their predecessors or successors.